Bibles, would you turn with me, please, to the book of Matthew? Matthew chapter 5. Some of you are new faces tonight in town to visit family or home from college, and so briefly, by way of explanation, we're working our way through the Lord's Sermon on the Mount, and we find ourselves this evening in verse number 38. So we'll read the text, verse 38 down through verse 42. I think we'll find that as we delve into this, that God, who has been at work in your lives and through the testimonies that we've heard this evening, and as he does so often in what Pastor has said this morning, is going to be saying many of the same things to us this evening. So, Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 38, Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away." I don't know if you've ever noticed in your time, either as a child or in your time being around children, that children have a very powerful sense of justice. You hear them say that often repeated little phrase, "It's not fair," right? And they're saying that because as they understand it and from their viewpoint, what is happening in life at that moment is not just, it is not fair, it is not equitable. And of course, the individual being denied the justice is the little guy saying, "It's not fair." You know, it's a very natural human desire for us to seek to have justice given. We like justice. I don't know if you've ever seen a movie or read a book or even seen an occasion in life where the bad guy, at the very end of it, gets away. He doesn't get what's supposed to come to him. He doesn't get what he deserves. And when we come to the end of that, we say, it was a bad ending, right? It doesn't satisfy. I feel like I want to go in there and justify things. I want to make things right because, after all, that lousy guy deserved it. And so we have in us a very strong desire for justice. It's a sense of right and wrong that God has built into every person. It's called the conscience. And this conscience that God has given to every individual is something that longs for justice. It cries out against wrong. It convicts us of the evil that we do. It warns us of judgment. And it makes us desire justice and judgment in other situations of life where things do not seem to be correct. And God tells us of this conscience in all people in Romans chapter 2. But that conscience that God has given to every person is by our sin natures warped. It is perverted. It is twisted. So that now my perceptions and my feelings about justice are not exactly correct. They're not always right. They're not always true. Take, for example, my brother and I. There were some years where my brother and I fought a bit, and it was never my fault. It was always his fault. I just want to clarify that right now. But sooner or later, a comment is made, a punch is thrown, and having been punched, it now becomes my duty to make things equal. And so, of course, to being the great defender of justice that I was, I punched him back. Only the same size punch that he punched me with, of course, right? Well, then he punched me back, and I punched him back, and each person who punched harder and harder. Because as we're punched, or as we're in a dispute, or something that annoys us, we say, you know, I'm going to serve some justice. I'm going to make things right. And so the sense of justice in us is very strong. But it is not necessarily something that is fair. It's not something that's equitable, because in your nature and in my nature, it is very much a natural part of us to give back more than what we got from someone else. And that happens because we want to defend ourselves. And so we, as people, just by our very nature, love to defend ourselves and protect ourselves when wrong is done to us. And this is really the subject of what Jesus is speaking of in this passage which we read tonight. This is the heart of what he is saying. For those who haven't been coming, just by way of context here, Jesus is preaching a sermon to a group of people, and the subject of his sermon is the kingdom of heaven. He's telling us, really, in this sermon thus far, let me tell you what the citizens of this glorious kingdom of heaven look like. Let me tell you how they live. Let me show you this. Of course, in the specific context of the day he was preaching, there were these people called the scribes and the Pharisees. They were the religious leaders. And they, of course, thought that they would be a part of God's kingdom. And Jesus, in his preaching here, is very plainly telling them that they are not a part of his kingdom. In fact, it was impossible for them to enter his kingdom because they were trusting in a system of works, of righteous deeds, good things that they could do. It's a system that they had established and kept to very meticulously, and they thought that if God saw their good works, he would be obligated to reward them by giving them heaven. And Jesus here is very plainly saying that your good works are not sufficient to allow you entrance into the kingdom of heaven. And he says it nowhere more plainly than he does in verse 20, where he says, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of these two groups of people, the scribes and the Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." Well, who then could possibly enter heaven? How could it be possible to be more righteous than these scribes or more righteous than these Pharisees? What does that righteousness look like? And Jesus, in his preaching here, describes. Let me tell you about the kind of person who is more righteous than the scribes and Pharisees. They're righteous because they're righteous on the inside. And he tells us about it in what we call the Beatitudes, those first 12 verses that we find there. These are the kind of people who enter heaven. And then He comes now to the end of chapter 5, and he gives six examples of the difference between an outward works righteousness, like the scribes and Pharisees had, and an inward God-given true righteousness that he has described throughout his sermon. And we've looked at these examples, we've seen in these examples that all of us really by our human nature fall short. I hope you see that as we've worked our way through these examples. Just by your natural human fleshly tendencies, you fail in every one of these examples. You are, in verses 21 through 26, you are a murderer in your heart because of your anger towards other people. You are an adulterer in your heart, verses 27 through 30. Again, he carries on the theme of adultery and broken marriage relationships in verses 31 and 32. As we saw last week, many of us are liars because we do not keep our word. And so we find ourselves falling desperately short, and that is one of the points of Jesus' sermon here, to tell us, you know what? You need to be righteous. You cannot do it on your own. And he describes for us now in these examples a contrast. There are those who fall short as murderers and adulterers and liars, but then there are the people of God's kingdom who live in such a different way. They practice reconciliation in their relationships. They practice purity in their hearts. They practice faithfulness in their marriage. They practice truthfulness in their speech. Now we come to the fifth example that we find tonight in verse number 38. In this passage, Jesus again is highlighting the difference, the distinction between those who are part of his kingdom and those who are not. And I would say that nothing or no other example that he's given thus far highlights the difference between the followers of Jesus Christ and those who are not the followers of Jesus Christ more than this passage that we're looking at right here. This one sets them very much at distinctions. We come to this passage and we find that there's a shift in what Jesus has been talking about. He's been talking about the times when we do wrong, our sins. And when we come to this passage, we find tonight that he's not talking about so much what we do in our wrong, but when wrong is done to us. And Mark Minnick said, "Nothing displays our depravity more than our response when wrong is done to us." Because we think, I've got my rights. You can't do that to me. You can't step on my rights. We live in a day of rights, and it's not new. Human nature has always been bent on protecting, on defending our personal rights, on defending and protecting, can I say it this way, self. Selfishness is the engine that drives our defense of rights, and when self is in the foreground, everyone and everything else is in the background. And Jesus now turns the spotlight on our selfishness, on our defense of ourself and of our rights. And really, the issue at stake here is our, what we would call, our right to retaliate when someone does wrong to us. And Jesus teaches here by some very searching examples that a believer should be willing to relinquish all of his rights rather than ever retaliate, because this is the mark of a true follower of Jesus Christ. And as he's done in all the previous examples, he begins by stating what was being taught. And he does this in verse number 38. Here we have a very well-known phrase, which comes even into our day. You've probably heard the phrase, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And he states it there in verse number 38. This is what was being taught. Now, does this teaching have any basis in Old Testament law that God gave? Well, in fact, it does. We find as we look in the Old Testament, and I won't take you to all those passages, but there are three passages in the Old Testament where God plainly declares this law. Life for life, he says, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe, fracture for fracture. It is the law that God gives. But let me clarify a few things that we find in the context of where God gives this law, okay? The first thing we see about this law is that it is to be carried out by civil authorities. It is only to be carried out by courts, by judges, by justice systems. It is not a law that is given to individual people to be carried out in personal relationships. This law is actually never intended to be used in personal relationships. In our personal relationships with other people, we're not to function as courts function. That was wrong, you go to jail. We function as people who God tells us are to forgive and be gracious and loving and kind towards others. But courts are not to function as personal relationships do. They're not to be kind and forgiving and letting people go. They're supposed to be giving justice. And the teaching, or really the subject of what Jesus is bringing up here and in this Old Testament law, is equal retribution. The punishment that is given must always fit the crime equally. It is equal to the crime. The punishment must be balanced, it must be measured out, and it must be given without pity. The courts were not to pity the individual who was to be punished. And so we see that in the giving of this law, it was actually a good law that protects individuals. It protected the person who was harmed, who was injured, because there was an equal punishment for the person who harmed them. And it protected the person who did the harming, because there wasn't a vengeance or a mob or a posse or a personal vendetta that was coming back on them. And so it was a good law that protected both individuals. But the problem with this law is very similar to what we've seen with so many of the other examples that Jesus brings up here. They had taught it wrong, and they had practiced it wrong. As the religious leaders, these scribes and Pharisees had missed the point in what this law was, and they had twisted it, and they had warped it, and they had made it fit their natural human desire so that they could do what they wanted to do. They could get back. And they thought that they could still be obedient to God's law in doing that. And specifically in this case, they had brought this law out of the courts and they had made it a personal thing, and they had taught, if someone wrongs you, you can wrong them back. You just have to make sure that as you retaliate, it is equal retaliation. And that's never what God intended in this law. And so here they were feeling that they were justified for getting revenge when someone wronged them. And they had sadly perverted what God intended in this law. He never intended it to be used in personal relationships. It was intended to be used in courts and judicial places. And so brought into personal relationships, when someone wrongs me, I can give justice and I become judge, jury, and executioner. And as we mentioned before, in my desire to give back to people, I end up giving them more than what they gave to me. And so this was a perversion of God's given law, and Jesus now corrects what God intended in this law, as he's done every time. And he helps these who are hearing him understand what true citizens of his kingdom look like. They are radically different because the responses when they are wronged are different. And here's really what Jesus is saying. He's saying that Christians, those who are part of his kingdom, are not to live lives that get even when wrong is done to them. We're not to be living by this retaliation idea or principle. And Jesus really is, of all these things, the perfect example. Think of him on the cross. There he is hanging. You think of if you heard what Pastor said in explaining the crucifixion, the difficulty just of breathing and having to pull yourself up to exhale and therefore to speak. And you only have so much strength and you only have so many of those breaths. And I thought, would I waste one saying something to these people crucifying me? No way. And yet from the cross, Jesus looks down at those crucifying him and says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Well, what does Jesus teach concerning this? What does God intend? Verse 39, it's stated very plainly, "But I tell you not to resist an evil person." That statement there, where Jesus says, "I tell you not to resist an evil person," has been horribly misunderstood and horribly misapplied by many, many people through the years. I won't take time to bore you. I'll skip some sections in my notes here. But there have been people who have taken this statement to say that we are to never resist evil in any form or in any way. And that means that nothing should resist evil. No human government, no police, no personal resisting of evil. If I see a grandmother being mugged over there, I cannot resist that evil person. If someone breaks into my house to kill my family, I cannot resist that evil person. I do not resist evil in any way or in any form. Tolstoy got a hold of this and he wrote much of his philosophy in his books coming from a wrong understanding of what Jesus taught here. Gandhi picked up on it, and it really is not what Jesus was saying here, because God tells us that he has established human institutions to resist evil. Romans chapter 13 tells us that government is one of them. It is God's minister for good to bear the sword and execute wrath on those who do evil. And God tells us that we, as his people, are to resist the devil, who is evil. And so what Jesus is not saying is that as Christians we're to be doormats here for anyone who wants to take advantage of us. Just come on, Christians, we won't resist you. That's not what he's saying. What he is saying is that in our personal relationships, when someone does wrong to me, the evidence of a genuine Christian is that I do not retaliate. I do not give back evil for evil in my private and personal relationships with other people. Yes, we can defend our families. Yes, we can protect the elderly grandmother. Yes, we can have governments and police forces. But when I resist evil, I don't resist evil as a personal vendetta to harm that person who did me evil. And that's the difference that Jesus makes here. He says that here we are, if you're saved, a Christian, a citizen of his kingdom. And I say to us, don't take this verse and misuse it as others have done. Don't seek vengeance because of this verse, and don't misunderstand it in the wrong way and not resist evil at all. And Jesus here in his teaching gives us four illustrations in the rest of this, four illustrations of everyday scenarios that happen in life that drive home his point of what he's talking about here. Okay, the first illustration we find in the end of verse 39, and that is an illustration about a personal insult. Second half of verse 39, he says, "But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also." It speaks of a slap in the face. If you've ever been slapped in the face, you know that's a very insulting thing to happen. It's demeaning. It was said at the time that a slave would rather be whipped with a rod than slapped in the face by his master's hand. And so a slap in the face is a very insulting thing. But Jesus here adds more than that. He says, whoever slaps you on the right cheek, assuming that most people are right-handed, he's probably referring here to a backhanded slap on the cheek. And of course, we know that that is very much an insulting type of gesture. And Jesus says to us here, when you are slapped, when you are backhanded on the cheek, instead of returning evil for evil, you are to turn the other cheek. In other words, when you're insulted, when you're maligned, when you're treated with contempt, Jesus says your response is to rather take it again. And really, I think if we had another cheek, take it again and take it again rather than retaliate. The second example we find in verse 40. He says, "But if anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic," really as they dressed in these days, there was an outer coat, kind of a thicker garment that they wore, and inside that was a long shirt that was like a tunic. "If anyone wants to take away your tunic, they've sued you, let him have your cloak also." So here the example is of someone who is sued in court. It's assumed that the wrong was yours because they want to take away your shirt. And if they want to sue you and they want to take your shirt, Jesus says, rather than return evil for that or file a countersuit, you offer that to them your coat as well. And Old Testament law in Exodus chapter 22 actually forbade those who took a pledge from someone, and if this outer coat was given as a pledge, God says you cannot keep it overnight because that person needs that coat to sleep in for their warmth. It's all they have. And if you keep it overnight, they'll cry to me and I'll avenge them. And so you couldn't keep this outer coat overnight. And Jesus here says, if they want to sue you and take your shirt, you willingly give to them your coat as well. You can't imagine what this might be like. Can you imagine if you were sued in court and you raise your hand and you say, you know, Judge, I know they're suing me for $100,000, but I was just wondering if I could make it $150,000 because I've really done some harm and I realize there's been some hurt here. It's a tremendous example. Verse 41 is the third example. Whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. This is an example of a personal loss of freedom and really a huge inconvenience, I think. It's an illustration that we don't so much understand in our day, but given in Jesus' day, this illustration was probably tremendously upsetting and shocking to the people who heard it. Here's Israel, and they're an occupied country. They're occupied by Rome. And here the Roman soldiers have the right to commandeer any Israelite they want to carry their things for them. And so if the Roman soldiers are traveling and they want to move some equipment or some gear or their own pack is too heavy or whatever they want, they can grab you as a citizen and make you carry their gear for a Roman mile, which is slightly less than our mile. We see this example when Jesus is carrying his cross and he falls under the weight of it and can no longer carry it. And they grab from the crowd a man, Simon of Cyrene, and they make him carry Jesus' cross. And the Israelites hated this because they hated Rome. They hated the fact that they were occupied. And they hated that they could be forced to carry their equipment, their things that would most likely be used against them out of the way, perhaps even carry it the opposite direction that they were heading, and to do it for no pay. And Jesus says, rather than grab their stuff and cuss them in your head and maybe drop it a few times along the way, or walk your mile and smile, he says, carry it 2 miles. And so when our personal liberties are infringed, when our schedules and our time is inconvenienced, would we be willing to give more to people we already don't like? Fourth example comes from verse 42. This is our personal sacrifice of the goods, the things that we have to those who are in need. Jesus says, give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. So someone here in need comes to you, and I stress, I think this is someone in need. You're not giving money to a drunk to go out and buy more alcohol, but this is someone with a need, comes to you, and they ask of you something to help them. You have the financial ability to help them with whatever their need is. Jesus says, give it. Don't stop and, you know, hey, I got about 30 minutes of papers to sign. If you just might come in my house, we could get some papers signed, and we'll schedule a repayment plan. And I've got low interest rates compared to all the other people around here. You know, I'm saying that. He says, just give it to those who ask you. And if they want to come and borrow something, you give it. And you don't even think about, when am I going to get it back? And am I going to get it back in the same condition I lent it out? You're not going to mess it up, are you? You just give it. And you don't think of getting it back, and you don't think of what it might cost you. So when the annoying neighbor comes and rings your doorbell and asks to borrow your car to put his Christmas tree inside and bring it home, you give. And you don't think a thing about getting it back. Or when they come and they ask for money to pay for their medical bills, you give. And you do not even think of getting it back. Now let me say, having gone through these four examples, I don't know if you, like I was this week, are experiencing the weight that these examples bring. There's a tension here that when we talk about these things, inside there's a little bit of strife, a little bit of tension. I don't know if you're provoked a little bit by the standard that Jesus sets, if in your own heart you have a little bit of resentment. Can you believe that Jesus would ask that of me? I mean, I found myself this week saying, is this really what Jesus says? Perhaps he means something different than what it sounds like here. This seems like a little bit too much. He's gone overboard this time. After all, nobody likes personal insult. Nobody likes to give more money to someone who's suing them. Nobody likes to give more freedom to people who they already are irritated by. Nobody gives or lends without thinking of return. I don't. I'm a cheapskate. Dave Overcast says frugal. That's a better word. Frugal. But Jesus here in his teaching knows our hearts. And he's given these examples really for the very purpose of creating this tension, this weight inside you. And what Jesus has done is he has very skillfully called your attention to the source of the problem that he's wanting to deal with. And the problem that he's wanting to deal with and that he's calling your attention to is your selfishness or yourself. It's a very natural thing. This teaching goes absolutely contrary to my flesh. It goes absolutely contrary to my human nature. I actually enjoy retaliation. And don't look at me weird, because you do too. And Jesus here has pointed out the issue that makes our obedience to these statements difficult, and that issue is our selfishness. These examples, quite frankly, irritate me, because in all of these examples, myself has something to lose, and I love myself. I don't like getting my rights stepped on or my rights trampled or my possessions taken. I don't like being inconvenienced. I don't like giving my money, and I don't like having my reputation
soiled.
But may I say to us, I think, what Jesus is saying here, and that is that true followers of Christ must relinquish their rights if they're going to follow him. And this is the thing that sets true kingdom citizens so different from an outward works righteousness. Jesus says this later on in Matthew chapter 16. He says, if we're going to follow him, we must abandon ourselves. We must deny ourselves. He says, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself. Let's deny your selfishness. Take up your cross and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life, Jesus says, gives of himself for my sake will find it. For what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world, has all the stuff, and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? And typically, we're more concerned about all of these things. My reputation, my possessions, my money. Than we are about being a self-denying follower of Jesus Christ. And Jesus really has probed the heart of the issue, and the heart of the issue is that I love myself. This is, as I said at the beginning, exactly what Pastor was saying this morning. He said again and again, self-denial is the heart of Christianity. Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2 tell us that we must die to self. We must give ourselves as a living sacrifice. And this is so contrary to our human nature because we say, it's my cheek, it's my respect, it's my shirt, it's my life, it's my plans, it's my time, it's my convenience, it's my stuff. And Jesus says that self can't follow Christ. Self must die at the cross, the place where righteousness was given. And self must die on a daily basis. It's impossible for us to live for self and to live for Christ at the same time. And so daily, I present myself as a living sacrifice to God. And it is then no longer my way, my things, my rights, my desires, my time, my plans, my life. Rather, Jesus here is saying in no uncertain terms that our surrender of self, our death to self, is the mark of a true follower of Christ. And it is an evidence that we are citizens of his kingdom. George Mueller wrote, "There was a day when I died, utterly died to George Mueller and his opinions, his preferences and his tastes, and his will. I died to the world, to its approval and its censure. I died to the approval or the blame of even my brethren and my friends. And since then, I have studied only to show myself approved to God." And so I ask you, are you dead yet? Let's bow for prayer. Very honestly, Lord, I must say that you have exposed my heart this week. My desire for retaliation when wrong is done to me, to get back or to get even, to defend my rights, it all comes from a deep down love of myself. And if I will come after you, if I will follow you, self must be denied, must be put to death, because I cannot serve two masters. And when myself is on the throne, you are not. So help me, Lord, to die to self, to daily deny myself. And may whatever issue that I would want to withhold from you so that I might be surrendered to you and live differently as a marked citizen of your kingdom be surrendered. I pray this evening for the people here. I don't know their hearts. I don't want to. But Father, you do. And I pray in the quietness of this moment that each of us would submit to whatever it is that you have put your finger on in our personal life, whether it is perhaps a bitterness in our heart against someone who has done wrong to us, and thoughts of retaliation or revenge, a desire to get back or to get even, whether it's thoughts of self, a love for our own dignity, our own possessions, my own freedom, my convenience, my things. May we surrender those things to you as a genuine follower of Jesus Christ. And Lord, I pray this evening, if there is one who is here who stands outside your kingdom, trying to do right, somehow to hope to please you, hoping to do enough right to someday find themselves accepted into heaven, I pray this evening you would convict them, show them that that is a futile struggle. There is no way you can do enough good to enter heaven. I pray you would draw them to yourself, to the cross, the place where righteousness is given. And may they give up themselves there. May you be placed on the throne. May they turn from their sin and accept and trust only in you as their personal Savior, and find themselves this evening citizens of heaven's kingdom. We ask these things in Christ's precious name.